All right. Last week we ended, and I drew this little hand-drawn chart on the board of how all the modern denominations came out of, basically out of the Reformation. And so I thought this week I would give you something better than the little hand-drawn chart on the board. Although, for anybody listening on CD or on the worldwide interweb, you won't get to see this chart. But it's a wonderful chart for anybody that can't see this. And I wanted to show you, because basically when we talk about the Reformation, and I had sort of taught it in this way, you know, you have the main Reformation, 1517, Martin Luther, he starts the ball rolling. So you sort of have three wings of the Reformation out of Europe. You have the Lutheran wing, you have the other reformers, basically the Calvinist wing, and then you have what happens up in the UK. You have the British Reformation. And those are really the three strains of the Reformation that end up branching off into all modern denominations just about. And then, like I say, the Catholic Church, which was sort of at Trent, it was locked into place. So anyway, this chart, if you're looking at it on the left-hand side, you'll see at the top it says Swiss Reformation. That's basically Calvin. I didn't create this chart. If I had, I would have said Calvin. The Anglican Reformation in the middle of it, which is what came out of Britain. Down at the bottom, you see the Lutheran Reformation. Then you see the Radical Reformation. Remember I talked about that at the time of the Reformation, you had Luther and Calvin, and you had a bunch of other guys. Sort of Zwingli was sort of the head of that, and they were the real radical reformers. They were the ones that even the Luther or Calvinist reformers went, well, time out, you guys are running way too far afield. And so if you look at this chart, you'll see that if we look at the Lutheran Reformation towards the bottom, you see that basically it branched out into Lutheran churches and free churches. The Lutheran churches today, you know, in the U.S. we have the Wisconsin Synod, the Lutheran Missouri Synod, which is, if you're Lutheran, the only true Lutherans. Well, they'll tell you that, everybody else won't. And then you have the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, the ELCA, which actually was a blend of two separate groups back in the 80s. The LCA and the Lutheran Church of America and the Evangelical Lutheran Church, the ELC and the LCA, and they blended together to make the ELCA. So that's really three branches of Lutheranism that came over, that we see in America, that came directly from Lutheran. The Free Church is actually, they're a blend of Lutheran, Swedish, and Norwegian. As it hit here in America, it really is the Evangelical Free Church of America, which happens to be that EV Free is where I, that's my home church, is an EV Free Church. And we know that the free stands for the fact that you don't have to put anything in the collection plate. No, that we joke about that when we don't feel like putting anything in the collection plate. So you do have the free churches, comes out of the Lutheran tradition. If you go up to the top, you see the Swiss Reformation. These are really the Calvinist churches. You get the Reformed churches, the Scottish Presbyterian churches, and you can see that they all kind of break out, Christian Reformed, Reformed Church in America, and interestingly enough, the United Church of Christ, one branch of that. And then you see all the Presbyterian churches, which from the Scottish trend came, and we see the breakout in America, in the New England Presbyterian churches. So you see all of those. The Presbyterian church, again, in America is in huge flux right now. As the Baptist church was a number of years ago in the Lutheran church, they're still trying to decide between the conservative branch and the very liberal branch. Just the past week, the Presbyterians had their large conference, and they have agreed to approve non-celibate gays in committed relationships in the ministry, and they've also put together a paper that 85% of them approved that we should cut off funding to Israel because of the Palestinian situation. Presbyterians.
So USA?
Yeah, so you can see that there is an extremely liberal wing within. There is also a very conservative wing in Presbyterians coming back. There's still flux there. And then you see in the middle, on this chart, they call it the Anglican Reformation. This is the Reformation that came out of England. The two main groups, remember we talked about this, you have the Episcopal Church, you have the Church of England, and you have the Puritans, which were the folks who were affected by Calvinism. That's why there's that little arrow from Swiss Reformation over there. And so you had these two main groups, and as they sort of filtered through here in the U.S., You have the Methodist wing. You have the Protestant Episcopal Church, which is basically the Church of England here in America. And then you have all the breakouts from the Puritans, and you notice there Congregationalism and Baptist churches, which were the two that really we got here in America. You see there is a tie between the United Church of Christ. They do come out of both a congregational or a reformed, depending on the UCC that you're at. The Baptist churches had their big thing where they were, depending on whether they were Arminian or Calvin in Europe, and that sort of came over here. Also, the Civil War divided the main Baptist church here in America, the Missionary Baptist, into the Northern and Southern Baptist Conference. Northern Baptist Conference gave us the American Baptist Church and whatnot. Southern Conference gave us the Southern Baptist Convention. So you can see the breakout of the Baptists. Down at the very bottom of the page, you see what's called the Radical Reformation, the Mennonites, the Moravian. Remember I told you that out of the Radical Reformers, there was this guy named Menno. Well, that's where we get the Mennonite Church. You can see there's almost a direct link between the modern Amish, Mennonite, Moravian brethren back to those radical reformers. And then you have the Restoration Movement, which gave us the Disciples of Christ and the Churches of Christ, which are different than the United Churches of Christ. So I want you to see this chart to see how all this stuff that we talked about in the Reformation sort of filtered down to what we have today. This is a much better chart than that little thing I drew on the board at the end of class last time. So the impact of the Reformation and what happened in Europe directly affects everybody sitting in some sort of denominational church today. Now, the other thing that's happening now it's a real contemporary thing is that you have these small house churches popping up a lot that are not affiliated with any particular denomination. What's interesting, though, is nowadays a lot of folks that are doing that are bringing with them sort of the theology that they got and the practice that they got in the denomination they grew up in or that they separated from. And so it's really hard to find a true non-denominational church. Most non-denominational churches usually look Baptist or they look Presbyterian, just without the robes and the altars, you know. So, but I want you to see this because, you know, a lot of times we say, well, why does it matter what Calvin did or what Zwingli did? And you say, well, because it plays out today in the churches here in America. And that's sort of the list of the chart of how the churches go. Okay, so now we want to talk today, because we have 3 weeks, tonight, 2 more weeks. We want to talk about Christianity, the church coming here to America. Really, the Christian church came to America on the East Coast and on the West Coast and up through Florida. And on the top, sort of down through Canada and the Northeast. Now, the top part of America, it was really Russian and French to a large extent. Minimal impact. I mean, it's there, but it doesn't have the huge hit. What the big thing that affects religion in America, the church in America, is what hit the East Coast in the original 13 colonies, and what Spain did coming to what's basically California, Mexico, and then coming up through Central America, kind of hitting into Florida and the Gulf area. And so we're going to see that in my opinion, that's where the biggest impact came from when the church hit in those two areas. The Spanish interaction in the Americas brought Catholicism. Wherever Spain hit, that's Catholic influence. Where the East Coast, that was primarily a British Protestantism. So you're going to see the Church of England, and you're going to see the various breakouts from that, primarily the Puritans. And so the East Coast has that impact. This was all the church in America, like the church everywhere else, is not free of politics and the economy. And so how the church interacted, what the church did in America, was tied together very tightly with the economics and with the political structure of the American colonies and with the Spanish interaction in the South and the Southwest. Before we go any further, though, I need to comment on this because this comes up, and I just figure we'll get this out of the way now, and then we won't have to worry about it too much later on. is that there are two extreme views of the impact of Christianity in the Americas and the indigenous people of the Americas. Okay, one extreme view is that the indigenous people in the Americas, who had been here for a long time, were basically ignorant, godless savages that needed people to come over here and just baptize the heck out of them and turn them into good, upright Christians. The other extreme view is that the indigenous peoples here in America were these wise, innocent people living in unity with each other in the land, and the evil Christian church came over from Europe and destroyed their beautiful, perfect way of life. Neither one of those extremes are true. Okay? Neither one is correct. Mostly nowadays you hear the latter view. You don't hear that the godless savages needed religion. You don't hear that much nowadays. You do some places, but not much. Nowadays you hear mostly anti-Christian arguments about how the innocent, pure indigenous people were destroyed by Christianity. And depending on where you're at, they were either destroyed by the evil Spaniard Catholics or they were destroyed by the evil Protestant Christians up north or down south. That's not really true. It's interesting, though, that the English Protestants and the Spanish Catholics interacted very differently with the indigenous people, and they did it, okay, in my opinion. Not the opinion of Hadavard nor the Irvine Community Church. So don't sue them, sue me. They did it really based on economic reasons and social reasons. When the Spaniards came to Central America, up to the U.S., they basically were coming to conquer. It was a military deal. They just happened to bring some Franciscans and Dominicans along with them and a couple of Jesuits. But they were trying to conquer land, and they found just piles of gold sitting around that they said, this is great. We can gather up all of this. We can send it back, and there's tremendous resources here. Well, they needed a labor force. Well, the religious people that were with them, the Franciscans, Dominicans, a couple of Jesuits, they said, oh, this is great. The way we do this is we convert all the Indians that are here, and we clean them up, and we make them really good European Catholics. And in that way, we'll have a very orderly society, and we'll have a workforce that will be productive and compliant, and we can get all this gold back to Spain. Okay? Now, on the East Coast, when the Protestants came, there were no piles of gold lying around. Maybe down in Florida, but certainly not up in the original colonies. What ended up being the thing was it was agriculture. Agricultural practice was what was the resource of the East Coast. And so what the Protestants needed was land. They really didn't need a workforce. They needed land that they could plant tobacco and the main crop that they had. So they really didn't care about, for the large part, converting the native people. They needed land. So they got the land, however, through trading with them or through taking it away from them. Later, when they needed a workforce, they chose to import the workforce through slavery, as opposed to the way the Spaniards had, converting the native people into the workforce. The Spaniards later on, when all the gold that was lying around big piles on the ground it was gone, and they needed land at that point, well, they did exactly what the Protestants had in the East by saying, okay, we're just going to gather up the land, and you create missions, and you stick all the Indians on it, and we farm all the land. So the interaction, in my opinion, was largely devoid. It wasn't a religious decision. It was a practical, social, economic decision. How do we do this? There were people in both groups, English Protestants, Spanish Catholics, who cared deeply for the indigenous people that they found and brought them the gospel and witnessed to them and were largely very successful. The interesting thing, in the East, a number of Indians who were Native Americans who converted to Christianity ended up being ostracized by their own people because they didn't fight in the wars. The when the Indians were saying we need to kill all these people coming in here trying to take our land and wipe out the white settler, these Indians who had converted to Christianity said, no, we can't do that. And so there was a real problem internally because of that. In the Spanish Catholics that came, many cared deeply for the plight of the Native American people and tried to help them and bring them, albeit not to Protestantism, which we would like because we're all Protestants, but bring them to Catholicism. But there were also people who, just like there are sinful people everywhere, exploited the Native Americans. So to say that it was either the godless savage that needed to convert or the perfect peaceful indigenous people who were oppressed, neither one of those is true. It was a mix. And a lot of the interaction had to do with the economy and the social structure. So, and I know that when I say that, that always bothers people because there are people that like both of those extremes or a variation of those. But when you do history, you have to be factual about your history. You have to pay attention to what's there and what people wrote and what people said and did. And you have to be honest when you study history. If we understand that it is true that God has interacted in human history, and as biblical, as Bible-believing Christians, as people of the book, we prove the truth of our religion, proving the historical facts of God interacting with history, we have to apply the same methodology when we look at history of what we've done in the history of the church. We can't just say, well, it's really true that God interacted in the history of Israel and that God interacted in you know, the physical, actual, historical Jesus rising from the dead and the real facts of the early church that we have in the New Testament. But you know what? When it comes to what Christians did in the New World, well, then we just don't have to be that factual. We can be more philosophical. We can't do that. We have to be true to history across the board. So the interaction with the Native American people was a little more complex sometimes than we like. Okay, so the church comes to America. I'm not going to look a lot tonight, at all, about the Spanish Catholic conquest because this is a Protestant church, and so we want to look at the history of the church coming out of Protestantism. And that all happens over on the East Coast and primarily with the original 13 colonies. Now, I've given you two handouts here. One is this really wonderful map that I did. Yeah, sure.
The Catholic Church is not listed on here.
Correct.
That means that's because this Reformation has to do with England and the Catholic was in the Spain.
Okay, the question is on the chart, the Reformation churches, I don't list the or the person that made this chart. I stole it from somebody. Well, the question is, why aren't the Catholics on this chart? One, this is particularly to look at denominations that came out of the Reformation, which will be all Protestants just by definition. Secondly, the Catholic Church did come into America, primarily through Spain, but also through France. The Orthodox Church came into America through Russia. And so, and we'll see in just a minute that one of the original 13 colonies was a Catholic colony that came over from England when Charles I came into play and said, well, we're all now going to be Catholics in England. So the Catholic Church did come into America in a tiny way on the East Coast, in a big way in the South, through the Spanish churches. But this particular chart was just meant to show where the Protestant churches came from. They're honestly, the Catholic Church, and this is a somewhat of an oversimplification, but the Catholic Church has stayed just ramrod straight. I mean, it really didn't break off. There are breakoffs. There's an American Catholic Church. There's an old Catholic Church. There's an Anglican Catholic Church. There are some fragmented versions of Catholicism. But for all intents and purposes, the Catholic Church at Trent is the same Catholic Church that shows up here in Maryland. It's the same Catholic Church that is here today. It really didn't fragment in the way that the Protestant churches did coming out of the Reformation. So that's why, I mean, if I did a chart with these churches, it would pretty much be a straight line. Right, there wouldn't be a whole lot of break. Now, if we were focusing on Catholic Church history, a good Catholic historian would tell you, well, no, there are some, you know, the Catholic Church did have its variations, but not so much, not like Protestant churches. It's pretty much a straight line. So that's why it didn't show up on this. Mainly this is all Protestant churches, but two, even if it did, it would pretty much be a straight line. Now, here in America, the two charts I've given you, one is the picture, because I'm a visual guy, I'm highly visual, so I assume that everybody else learns the way I do and you need to see things in visual form. If you're kind of a data person, auditory or whatnot, this will be helpful to you. If you're kinesthetic, feel free to walk around the room while you look at these charts. Whatever works for you in your learning style. But I gave you this because the way we have to understand the Christian church coming to America is you have to divide the 13 colonies into three areas: the northern colonies, the middle states, and the southern colonies. Because the church hit differently and interacted differently in these three areas, okay? Remember, in England, and I talked about this a couple of times, in England, Protestantism in England was divided into two large groups. There was the Church of England folks. Those were the folks that said the crown, the king or the queen, and the Christian church have to be tied together. The king or the queen has to be the head of the church, because there would be no social order without the king. So the Christian church drives its power from the king. The king drives, or the queen, whoever it is, gets their authority from the church. So the two of them are inseparable. Now, the other group in England, primarily because of the Calvinist influence, were the Puritans, who said, no, we need a biblically based Christian church, and it's not the same as the king. We don't want a church that has all the trappings of Rome, but instead of a pope, we just have a king or a queen. We need a church that's biblically based. And the influence came in from the Calvinist end of the Reformation. So in England, you have the two. You have the separatist group, the Puritans, who want sort of this Bible-based, Calvinist-like church. And then you have the other folks who say, no, the church is the Church of England. It's tied to the crown. The king or the queen is the head of the church. Both provide the power to the other. So when it comes here to America, we're going to see both of those ideas are represented. Okay? So, if we look at the northern colonies, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, and New York. I put New York in. Some folks, I think the text for the class puts New York as a mid-colony. I don't, and I'll tell you my reasoning in a minute. But the North, they came here for religious ideals, okay? This is the Puritans. The southern colonies, Virginia, North, South Carolina, and Georgia, really came here economically. These are the folks who will be the Church of England folks. The middle states are interesting. The middle states are sort of neither Puritan nor are they Church of England. They're all the mix of things. In the middle states, we add Maryland, which is the only Catholic colony. And really, Maryland and Rhode Island should be separated out and not considered as part of the North, the Central, or the South, because they are both, on their own, separate entities. So let me talk about Maryland, get that out of the way. Maryland was basically a Catholic colony. Not officially a Catholic colony, because everybody would have been upset by that. But they are, Charles I and was in office, and Lord Baltimore, he gave Lord Baltimore basically the permission to go found a colony so Catholics could have their own colony in the New World. That's Maryland. That's where it came from. It is predominantly Catholic. Interestingly enough, though, because of the social structure of the original colonies, the head people in Maryland, all the landowners, were all Catholic. All their servants, their indentured servants, were all Protestants. So Maryland had an interesting tug of war, because it was run by the Catholics, and they said this is a Catholic colony, but all the folks that were doing the labor, the indentured servants, all the sort of common people, were Protestant, and they kept saying, no, 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 we want to be our Protestant rights, you know, we don't want all this Catholic stuff. And depending on what happened in England, when Charles I left and James took over and whatnot, you get this shift in the colonies, where now all the Protestants said, yay, we're Protestant again in England. We don't want the Catholic rule here in America. And the Catholics saying, no, we're a Catholic colony. We're holding on. But that's really the only place Catholicism came in on the East Coast that wasn't a French influence. So we have Maryland. The other one that's the outlier is Rhode Island. And Rhode Island is a separatist colony as a refuge for people fleeing, and this always seems strange to us, the religious oppression that was taking place up in Massachusetts. So let me explain. I'll get to Rhode Island in a second. Let me explain what happens here. Basically, the very first colony, Virginia was the first. And it was folks came here to make money. That was the deal. In fact, if you look on this chart, the religions in the 13 colonies, and you look down at the main reason for coming, if you look at the southern colonies, top one is Virginia, economic gain. You go down and you look at North and South Carolina, economic gain. The only there was the religious freedom. That was the Huguenots fleeing the oppression in France. But mainly North and South Carolina are economic gain. And then you look down Georgia. Georgia's interesting. It was... The prison system in England was terrible. It was brutal. And it was packed because they had debtors' prisons. And so the idea came up in England, let's get rid of the folks that are in prison just because they couldn't pay their taxes. Let's ship them off to America and we'll have a debtors' colony there where instead of going to prison in England, you'll go to America. That's basically why Georgia started. Okay, but notice, none of the southern colonies, Virginia, the Carolinas, or Georgia, were based on religious freedom. These were economic. They came here and they figured out we can grow tobacco and we can make a whole lot of money by shipping it back, so that's what they did. The aristocracy, the folks from England who wanted to be landowners, who wanted to be the wealthy aristocracy, they came to the South. Notice the church that's prominent then in the South is the Church of England as the main church. These are the folks who said, we want to be successful in our land, in our farming, and the Church of England and the ties to England worked perfectly. Now in the North was sort of begun by, and this is true, we look at this every year at Thanksgiving, were the Pilgrims. Now they were the religious separatists. These were the folks who were persecuted in England, who didn't want the Church of England, who wanted a biblically based a non-king or queen-run church. They come over here and they primarily settle in the North, in New Hampshire, in Massachusetts, and in Connecticut. They set up house over here, and the Puritans said, we don't want the kind of church that was over in England. We want a very pure, Bible-based, good, strong Protestant church. The problem is, that's all they want. And they don't want anybody that doesn't want that. It's funny, most of us today who really view ourselves as good Christians, good church-going Protestants, would have hated to have been in one of those original colonies. We would have hated to have been in Massachusetts. Quite frankly, a number of us, our theology wouldn't have fit with what they taught because it was hardline five-point Calvinist theology. So those of us that aren't hardline five-point Calvinists would have struggled theologically. If you were a dispensationalist, they would have probably booted you occasionally. We would have been uncomfortable, I think, with the level of religious observance that was required. Church once or twice a day. Common church on Sunday for a long period of time. Not that I don't like spending 8 or 9 hours on any given Sunday at one church with no food event in the middle. But we would have found it to be, I'm assuming most folks would have found it to be fairly oppressive. But they had very strict requirements because you understand where they came from in England, they're called Puritans because they were trying to purify the Church of England. They believed that this was truly how you're to live, a Bible-based, a Christian lifestyle. Because of that, they were hugely intolerant to anybody that didn't hold that same hard line. Whether you were Church of England, whether you were Catholic, whatever you were. Now, the Congregationalists and Baptists that came out of the English Reformation had a little bit of trouble up there, as well as other folks. Now, what happened then in the North was that there was this discord between those that said, no, we came here for freedom, and that means freedom, and those who said, no, we came here for freedom to have the church the way we think it ought to be. Well, they broke off. A guy named Roger Williams broke off and got permission to have his own colony, which is Rhode Island, which was founded on the belief of complete 100% religious freedom. No matter how wacky your theology might be to everybody else, you have as much right to put a church on Main Street as the guy next to you does. And so Roger Williams founded Rhode Island based on this idea of religious tolerance. And it was to separate out from the very strict Christianity that was being done up in the north, in the northern colonies. Now, 100 years ago, people would have said, well, Roger Williams wasn't that cool a guy. I mean, come on. You know, he was a little nutty on his theology. Nowadays, with this sort of postmodern mindset that's creeping even into our good Christian churches, that have the view that, well, there really aren't any absolutes. As long as you believe what you believe, that's good for you. Well, applaud Roger Williams, and he becomes the poster boy for all that is the allowance of all things universal beliefs. Neither one of those are completely true. It is true on the good side that Roger Williams was saying, you know, we can't persecute others the way we were persecuted based on strict theology. On the bad side, Roger Williams was kind of nutty. He got to the point where he really got, he loved the local Indian tribes and their mythology and their stories and everything. And he sort of constructed the idea that, you know what? Yeah, Christianity is true, but you know what? I think God's probably okay with all those crazy myths that the Indians teach, and I think they're probably saved as well. Which I don't know anybody in the Christian church would go along with. So, on one hand, he was right in saying that there can't be religious intolerance. On the other hand, he was wrong in that we can't say as Christians, well, everything's equal. So, Rhode Island has to be its own little separate thing out there. Now, then what we have left are the middle colonies. Now, let me talk about New York. I put New York as a northern colony, and I'll tell you why. New York was founded not by the Church of England. New York was founded by the Dutch Reformed. Okay, and they would be more akin to the Puritans in their strict Calvinist view than the southern guys, the Church of England guys. Okay. Now, what happened was eventually Britain took over. And when Britain took over and got New York, it was interesting. The only people that were Church of England people in New York at the time, when it became a British colony, was the governor of the colony and his wife. Everybody else was Dutch Reformed. Everybody converted. They changed everything over to the Church of England. So while we look at the southern colonies, we say they're all Church of England guys, they're not Puritans, they're not Congregationalists and whatnot. We look at New York and say, well, I know that's true, it's not really a middle state, though it really started out more, in my opinion, more akin to a northern colony in that it was in that Calvinist view, and it didn't become Church of England until later on. Then we have the middle states. Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware. We already talked about Maryland. Maryland and Rhode Island have to be sort of on the outside. But the middle states, the middle states got everybody else. Lutherans, Reformed, Quakers. If you look on your little chart here, that the number 53, if you look at the middle states, New Jersey and Delaware and Pennsylvania, and you look at the religious orientation, whereas in the other ones you see Congregationalists, Separatists up north. In the south you see Anglican. In the middle states you see Lutheran, Reformed, Quaker. Pennsylvania, William Penn was another one of these guys who was very open about what should be done in terms of the church. And you look, and Quakerism is very strong there. You look at all the Mennonites, the Brethren, the Amish, the Moravian Church. They were all seeking religious freedom from Europe, and they all came into Pennsylvania. So the middle colonies are kind of a mix and match of different church traditions. So in the north, you have the Separatists, the folks who left the Church of England, who wanted that biblically-based Calvinist sort of view. In the south, you have all the Church of England guys who say, nope, we need the church to have social stability, the Church of England is fine with us, yep, the king or the queen is the head of it, and we're good with this, we don't want to break out. And then in the middle colonies, you have sort of everybody coming in, the Lutherans, the Reformed, the Quakers, some of these other separatist groups looking for a place to stay. And then you have the two outlier colonies. You have Maryland, which was the Catholic colony, and you have Rhode Island, which separated within the colonies for Protestant religious freedom. The amazing thing about this is that that shapes our view of religion here in the U.S. In the U.S., we have just this huge mix of denominations. I mean, we do across the board. We, even though we completely disagree with others within Christianity, outside of Christianity, none of us feel the need to say, you know what? I'm a free church guy. The only church that we should allow is the free church. So those crazy Presbyterians, those wacky Lutherans, those nutty Catholics, those Jehovah's Witnesses, those Mormons, those Jewish guys, those Muslims, all of them, shut them down. We can only have the free church. In America, that's not the thought. Even though we disagree, even though we would stand up and say, you people are wrong and you're going to hell because of what you believe, it is a very rare thing to see anybody say, even with that said, you can't open the doors of your church. What happened in America with the Christian church in America is really just an extension of what happened in these 13 colonies. And within these 13 colonies, we see every aspect of what we see in the broader range of the American church. We see a separatist movement that wants to preserve authentic biblical Christianity. We see a group of folks that say, nope, the church is more a general social structure, and we should do church because that's good for society, and it's also good for the economy. And then we see a melting pot of all the different little groups that were persecuted back in Europe coming over here because they could follow their particular idea. And that's really good. The thing that has kept the Christian church alive for 2,000 years is the providence of God, and in the inner workings of the church where people can say, this isn't the way the church should be, I need to stand up and reform it, or I need to speak my theological view. And whether they were always right or not, the fact that that happened allowed for Luther to start the Reformation against Catholicism. It allowed the problems that were going on in the Eastern Church not to affect the Western Church in the split back in the 11th century. It has allowed the kind of reforming ideas that have been consistent in Christian theology always moving towards what is ultimately the true position. Now, it doesn't mean that all of this ever works out for good. The Christian church is full of a bunch of folks who have a sin nature, even those of us in this room, who we are the faithful remnant. And so we're going to bring all that sinful human nature into church. So the folks that came over here to try to find a good biblically based reformed theological church, the bad part came up where they started to say, okay, but that's the only way you can practice religion. And so a guy like Roger Williams had to break off. The folks that were getting persecuted because they didn't agree with French Catholicism had a place to go in the middle colonies to follow their particular view. Whether it was right or not, all of this is how the church in America has grown out of. And so it's important to see that the church in America wasn't just the folks in the Virginia colony, the Anglican church coming over here and then perpetuating itself in an American form. The church in America was not just the folks who came over on the Mayflower. The church in America was not just the Catholics who settled in the Southwest and in Florida and also in that one little strap of Maryland. The church in America has been shaped and influenced by how all these different groups hit into those original 13 colonies. Okay, this is real important to see. And again, I know this is tough sometimes because we are wired in our search for the truth and to serve God in true biblical Christianity, we are wired as Protestants to continually protest and to say, no, we've got to get back to the Scripture. The cry of sola scriptura is true from Luther to today. But the problem with that is that while we're continually protesting, so's the other guy. And so we get into a lot of these, and we don't want to allow that maybe that other guy protesting is kind of okay in some areas. We have to separate out always as we look at this. Again, I've said this before, Christianity in a sociological or anthropological context and Christianity in a theological context. In America, the Christian church in America, sociologically or even anthropologically, is anyone who says, I'm a Christian and I have this guy, Jesus Christ, as part of my theology. That encompasses everybody. That encompasses Southern Baptists, Catholics, Mormons, Presbyterians, because they all have Christian as part of their theology. They all have this guy, Jesus. Now, theologically, Christianity is a whole different deal. Theologically, you are a Christian because you've trusted in Christ for eternal life. You're a member of the universal church, not whatever your local church affiliation is. Theologically, you're a Christian because you believe certain truths, certain biblical truths about the person of Jesus Christ and the biblical God. So theologically, we can sit around and say, no, I'll give you a list of folks who claim to be Christian in America who are not Christians theologically. And I can debate theological Christianity all over the place, and I should, because the truth has to go back to the Scriptures. What I can't do is I can't overlap those two. I can, but I sort of do it at my own peril. Because on the sociological level, nobody's tying to the same thing to validate their position, other than that, well, we believe that we're Christian because we follow some variation of Jesus Christ. So on a sociological level, I can't validate 100% other than we've got Jesus Christ. This is where we get in trouble nowadays, where a popular culture goes against Christianity. Popular culture goes against theological Christianity, and they shouldn't. We also get in trouble sometimes as Christians making ourselves look a little bit nuttier than we should by trying to take the theological Christianity and expect somebody who only believes in a sociological Christianity to see our point of view. So this sort of pluralism that's here really comes out of this, what we see in the early interactions of the church coming to America. It doesn't mean that everybody that called themselves Christian in the church in America back in the 17th, 18th century was who we would say is theologically and honestly a Christian. But it also doesn't mean that we want to carry over the same kind of battles that were in Europe here into America with the Christian church either. The Christian church in America, I believe, is part of that ongoing providence of God. He said that the church would never fail, the gates of hell would never stand against the church, and I believe that we see the hand of God in America in the Christian church, as well as we can see the hand of God in the Christian church in Europe. The fact that George Washington, several times, was, I believe, miraculously protected during the War of Independence shows the providence, the hand of God towards Christianity in America. Just like the fact that the Muslim invaders decided to attack Germany right at a point where it looked like Protestant Christianity was going to be snuffed out, that was the providence of God there as well. It's the hand of God in the long stretch of the church. We can't ever say that any one action is, oh, that's it, that's the hand of God right there, so this is the only church. So I'm trying to show you that we have to be careful as we do this. If this was a theology class, I would be teaching this very differently. I would be showing you where the true biblical Christianity sort of filtered through and where they failed. But this is a church history class, so we need to look at all the historical evidence. Now, the thing that came out after these colonies was that we have a separation from England. It was tied to England to begin with. But more and more, we became independent entities over here. And the colonies became independent entities, and so did the churches. You have the War of Independence, which we won, by the way. Right? Good for us. The Church of England, I had a friend of mine did a blog on this just recently, and I found it fascinating because he was saying that the problem that the Christians have is that we're taught in the Scripture is that we're to honor our authorities, the civil authorities. Paul's very clear about that. And Paul tells us to honor the civil authorities at a time when the civil authorities were ugly, brutal, terrible pagan people. But Paul said, you got to honor the civic authorities. So is it right for Christians to have revolted against the civil authority, which was England? And then he says in his blog, he said, but the civil authorities didn't hold up their side of the bargain either. You know, they gave taxation without representation. They didn't want to give autonomy to us, even though it was promised in this structure. And so they reneged on their part of the deal as well. So ultimately, the fact that God had his hand on the outcome of the War of Independence, and America won, Washington survived, the Christian Church in America survived in the way it did, shows that of the two sides, God seemed to be okay with what went on over here in America. And so we see the hand of God there. So we're okay with this. But what happened was, we now became our own separate entities over here. The church in America became separate from what was going on in Europe. The good news for us is that we became separate from what was going on in Europe. The bad news was, as we became a separate entity over here, and as all this pluralism started to take place, we have some interesting events in the church in America with our own little separate groups that we had to decide, are they heretical, are they not? We had our own internecine fights within Christianity. The battle of Calvin and Arminius that was over in Europe continued over here in America. The Arminianism that was in the Protestant church in England and in Northern Europe came over here into America. The Calvinism that was in the Protestant church in Europe came over here into America. And so we have Calvinists and Arminians still arguing the same theological issues over here in American churches. The church in America also took on the social aspect and sort of the societal aspect of the American personality. America is a different country than Europe. Everybody I know that goes to Europe says, wow, you can pick out Americans at like 100 paces. They're just, there's this thing about Americans. There's sort of a common mind to being an American that is different than to being European or to being Southeast Asian or to being South American. And it's even different than being Canadian. They're way more polite than we are in Canada. But in America, there's sort of this personality, this American personality. Well, the church in America has that kind of personality as well. American Lutherans are not the same as German Lutherans. And so the way we practice religion here in America as the church is American in its particular personality and whatnot. And we'll see this as we go through over the next two nights, the next two Wednesdays, in the church here in America, what it looks like. The things that affected the church in Europe also affected the church in America. The pietistic movement that affected the church in Europe really was the holiness movement here in America. We'll see the rise of Pentecostalism here in America affecting how the Christian church looks. The arguments over church and state are not quite as big here in America because we have a completely different governmental structure, and our founding fathers did put into the Constitution this idea that the government could not tell a church what it had to do. I know that's been flipped around nowadays in popular culture, that most folks believe that the separation clause means that churches just can't exist. But what it really meant was that the government couldn't tell us what to do. It's sort of what Roger Williams said when he wanted to get Rhode Island going. So we'll see all of that over the next 2 weeks as we look at how the church in America goes. But realize, everything we're going to see has its origin in what happened in these 13 colonies. Again, with the exception of that Catholicism that came up in the Southwest, which is still an interesting thing because we have a real overlap now. It's interesting, Protestantism is now going down into Central and South America, and making great waves, and Catholicism seems to be doing a lot more in the Southwest now because of the immigrant community. So it's kind of interesting on that. But so anyway, but what we're going to see is going to tie back to all this stuff we looked at this evening. Okay, great. I will see everybody next Wednesday.